Thank you so much. That was so lovely. Good morning. I am Alicia Wood, the pastor here at this church, University United Methodist Church. We are so honored to have known and spent time with Jim. We are grateful that we are able to call him colleague, mentor, brother in faith, and friend. We are humbled to host this celebration of life. On behalf of myself and the congregation, welcome. Welcome to Jim and Betsy's family, and welcome, friends. May you find comfort and peace in this space. And the Bishop of the Upper New York Annual Conference sends his condolences, and I have a letter for you. So welcome all.
Thank you, Pastor Alicia, and thank you, Carl, for that prelude. Carl Sperber is the son-in-law of Jim Wiggetts. Dear friends, we are gathered here together in order to commemorate and to celebrate the life and the work of James B. Wiggins. My name is David Miller. A few days before his passing, Jim called me on the phone and said he had a few things he needed to talk to me about. He asked if I would come over to his house. I said yes. And when I got there, he asked if I would preside at a memorial service, if such there was to be. I told him that it would be difficult, but that I would be honored. Jim and I met in the fall of 1960, almost 57 years ago. We met at a German examination. We were taking a German exam in order to be admitted to the doctoral program at Drew University. Jim passed. I did not. And it was the same with the Super Bowl. Jim and I bet on every single Super Bowl, from the first one until the one just this past January. 51 Super Bowls, 51 bets. Jim won 42 of them. Which cost me a lot of dinners. But I have to say that Jim always paid for the wine. 42 bottles of wine. That was the spirit of Jim Wiggins. He had an amazing grace. I believe that his grace is expressed in a saying by the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus. Heraclitus once said, "The hidden harmony is better than the obvious." I take it that this means that any fool can see the harmony of things that are alike, that are same, but that it takes a special grace to sense and embody the harmony of things that are different, diverse. Jim could sense, and he embodied, that amazing grace. This is expressed beautifully in a prayer that Jim himself selected. The prayer is entitled, "We Rejoice in the Joy of Harmony." Let us pray. Mystery surrounding us, pouring out your benign energies with prodigality and profligate innovation, knowing us, nurturing us, caring for us, receive our prayer of awe and gratitude. We rejoice to contribute our personal minds to this elegant universe, concentrating on creating harmonies this day with all that exists amid the music of your benevolent presence everywhere. We contribute our hearts and our imaginations, all our bodily energies, and all our spiritual resources to this magnificent, evolving universe. You are with us. We cannot fail. So be it. Amen. Yes. We rejoice in the joy of hidden harmonies. The psalmist also has poetically affirmed this. Hear the words of Psalm 90. Lord, through all generations you have been our strength and our home. Before the mountains were born or the oceans were brought to life, for all eternity, you are. 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes. Teach us how short our time is. Let us know it in the depths of our souls. Show us that all things are transient, as insubstantial as dreams, and that after heaven and earth have vanished, there is you. Fill us in the morning with your wisdom. Shine through us all our lives. Let our hearts soon grow transparent in the radiance of your love. Show us how precious each day is. Teach us to be fully here. And let the work of our hands prosper for a little while. To give testimony to Jim's life and the work of his hands while he was here, I call first on Jim's brother, Mark Wiggins. Mark?
And realize that this is the guy I've heard about for years. And we said that in unison. At a loss for the proper words. No problem with volume. But to give you an idea about who my brother was and is, and our relationship, could go back to July in 1946, when he was 11 years old, standing watching an ambulance return his mother to the hospital through a complication of my birth that week. His dog Ring followed the ambulance, and as it turned the corner, he felt that he would never see that dog again, and he didn't. So there was a grudge held from the earliest of times that I did not hear about it once, but many times. The next time that we were drawn together by the hospitalization of our mom was in 1970, and we watched for 3 years as she bravely battled cancer. During that time was a time of a redevelopment of a relationship that evolved into the deepest of friendships. But the time that we were able to spend visiting about experiences of growing up in a Wiggins household that was completely different than the others' Wiggins household because of 11 years that separated us in age. But the idiocy of his location in Syracuse when he could be home at 85 degrees weather. We tried and tried and tried, but after our mom's death, our father was very lonely, and in an attempt to find an antidote, we found a rural piece of property that had been the town site of Horn Hill, Texas in 1846. We bought this piece of land, and the love that developed within our family for that piece of property became a tie that would bring my brother and family back to Texas just to see what the next adventure at Horn Hill would turn out to be. And we shared a enjoyment of a bard that he didn't get exposed to much in his life, but Merle Haggard had words of life changes all that it pertains to, except for memories, and the memory is stronger than time. So I throw that in that even in our recollection, it wasn't a casual change of our remembering. We relished in coming up with different recollections of the same event. And and this lore became part of our friendship. But this Horn Hill provided, this place provided opportunities for us to do things together personally, like rebuild a fishing dock out in a pond that the only disagreement we had was we agreed it happened, but how deep were we sunk in this muck as we did this? It was from waist high to deep high. One time we got to up to chest high. I mean, it would laugh. It would just be so enjoyable to think of the old circumstance in a new light. But the carpentry skills that were developed there were transferred to the farmhouse that our father felt it needed a bathroom built on, and that was a challenge for us to take on. The disagreement was whose mismeasurement was that caused the toilet to sit at an angle requiring a seat belt for security, or that misjudging the angle that the shower stall would have to sit in order to be able to drain, and it didn't. But just those kind of, you know, meaningless events, except against the backdrop of recalling and enjoying, didn't have to be earth-shattering in other measurements to take priority in a visit on the phone or in person. When I came up a couple of weeks ago and visited, we turned the conversation to laughter. And all of you that have known my brother know that he loved to laugh. And the volume of his laughter was bigger than his size. And so I tried to come up with a couple of recollections that would evoke laughter as he was sitting in his chair, and did. And we acknowledged at that time that while there were a lot of things that we probably needed to talk about, there were none as important as sharing a laugh. And we did. As I took his hand, reminding him that I love you like a brother, he smiled and he said, "Well, I am." And I squeezed his hand and said, "I know. Thank you."
Karis Wiggins is Jim Wiggins' daughter. Karis?
Good morning. With a full heart, I thank all of you. My dear family, our friends, colleagues of my father's, thank you for being with us today. Many of you have traveled great distances to share in the celebration of his life. I know that James Brian Wiggins, or Big Jim, as many of my early boyfriends referred to him, which he used to his advantage, you can be sure. I know my dad would be so humbled by your presence and by this memorial. Since my father's passing 2 weeks ago, so many people have so generously called and emailed and stopped in to share their memories of my father. These thoughtful messages and gestures of support have buoyed us as we mourn the loss of his mountainous physical presence. We are so fortunate to be part of this community. Thank you also, David Miller, for agreeing to preside over this service. I am sure this has not been easy, given your extraordinary friendship. David has been part of my life since my arrival on this planet. David is my godfather, not in the Marlon Brando sense of godfather, but as more of an ever-present figure in my universe. And I thank you for that as well, David. We will hear many things about my father today. I am sure they will include mention of his many varied academic contributions, his tireless work as an administrator and board member for countless charities and organizations, his deep love and even deeper hatred for the game of golf, his proud Texas heritage. As proud as he was to be a Texan, he is even prouder of our family members who still reside there. We will hear remembrances of his wry sense of humor and his masterful storytelling skills. I am here to offer a few thoughts on what it was like to be the daughter of James Wiggins. To reference Walt Whitman, my father was a man who contained multitudes. He was a complex man who rarely answered questions or commented on any topic without a great deal of thought. He preferred the deep end of the pool, as they say. My father did not believe in simple, unconsidered decision-making. Witnessing the strength of his intellect and his enormous capacity for recall, which was present until the very end of his life, was both humbling and awesome in the original intent of that word. In sharp contrast to my father's deep sense of silence was his loud, life-giving laugh.
My father could be quite stoic and so often visibly shouldered the weight of his own heavy burdens along with the burdens of so many people who found themselves in less fortunate circumstances than his. Just as so many children believed, I was convinced that my dad's body had been constructed with superhuman materials. This notion was actually later confirmed by a back surgeon who, after operating on my dad for 5 hours, came out and told us point blank, "Well, Jim's bones are actually made of concrete and steel." Once committed to an endeavor, my father's efforts were unwavering. He would square his shoulders as he had been taught in his early football training and not stop until the project was completed. A former colleague of my dad's recently shared with me that if my dad was involved in a project, he couldn't help but think that it would succeed. As a small child, I could feel this weight he carried and could sense the complex internal wrestling matches being held within him. Oftentimes, that sense was a bit uncomfortable for me, and I worried about him. My response to all of this was to sharpen my skills as a clown. I spent years at his feet, working as a court jester and safecracker of sorts. I was always searching for that perfect comic combination that would produce that quiet little click that preceded the release of his giant, glorious laugh. Nothing gave me more pleasure than cracking that code, and he loved being caught off guard. We played out that ritual nearly every time we were together. Humor always carried us through and deeply connected us. I had the great good fortune of learning from the best. I am frequently visited by a specific memory of my dad. During one of our many trips across the country to spend the summer either in South Dakota, where my mother's family was from, or in my dad's beloved Texas. On this one particular trip, my father was driving my brother and me, and for some reason, my hamster, to our family farm in Texas. I had somehow managed to convince my father that this fluffy teddy bear hamster had to make the journey with us. I am quite sure that if the hamster had been allowed to weigh in on the discussion, he would have voted to stay home and not endure the 90-degree heat he was about to be subjected to. So we have stopped on this particular trip at the Holiday Inn, and after having driven for something like 10 hours straight, my father changes into his swim trunks and takes us to play in the pool. I beg him to throw me to the other end of the pool. In my mind, I am right there again, my little yellow polka-dotted swimsuit and my tiny feet in his enormous hands, and my little fingers resting on those shoulders of concrete and steel. He bends down and then he stands up and throws me over his head. I am flying over that shock of white hair atop that tanned mountain, and I land in the deep end of the pool, just where he wants me. The landscape of my universe has been permanently altered by the loss of my father. I suspect I will spend the remainder of my life swimming through the water like memories of this man, my beloved, complex, holy father. Thank you, Dad, for the honor of being your daughter.
Brian Wiggins is Jim Wiggins' son. Brian?
So it's interesting, we both decided to share what it was like to be a son or a daughter of Jim Wiggins. For me, one thing was it was scary. I mean, the dude really was huge. I mean, everybody's talking about how big he was, but he was, you know, he was big, but he was also big in life. His big in a lot of ways. He was physically imposing. I think I really was off to college before my waist was bigger than Dad's arms. I mean, he just seemed, he was so big. People who knew our house on Westmoreland and our skinny little driveway that went into our garage, he put up a basketball hoop there when I was 12 or 13. And he would give me the ball and he would stand at the foul line. And there was nowhere to go. I couldn't get by him. I would try, and he would just twitch a muscle, and I'd go flying into the yard. But he wasn't just physically big. I think that's what we're all talking about here. He was just big in the world. His laugh was big and loud and resounding, the most infectious laugh I've really ever heard. And when he sang in this church and other churches, you could pick his voice out from anywhere in the room. He had the deep, resonant voice. You could probably hear him outside. And when Dad entered a room, for me, the light shifted. It just changed. His presence was commanding. Commanding is probably not the right word. I'm not sure what the right word is. Pervasive, maybe. Not in a physical sense, because Dad did devote a lot of his life to his career, to his work, and to golf. But somehow, it was like, for me, it was like he was always there, even when he wasn't. And I think that's because of the impact that he had on me. He reveled in just about everything I did. He made me think I was the best in the world at school, at sports, just being myself. He taught me to ride a bike right over in Broad Street Park. He taught me to swim and play golf and tennis and football and basketball. But what he really taught me was to believe in myself as an athlete. Despite my age and poor condition, I still think of myself as an athlete. I honestly feel like I could still dunk a basketball if I really had to. As some of you in here know probably all too well, I'm not much of a golfer. But many of my best memories of Dad were on the golf course at Drumlin's or Tecumseh or other places where we traveled. And he never seemed to care about how terrible I was. I'd shank the ball left, right, and center, and it had to be excruciating for him. I just can't imagine how embarrassed he felt for me. But he never showed it. He'd give me some tips and get me straightened out. And once in a while, I'd manage a good shot, and he made me feel like Tiger Woods. I mean, that's who he was for me. Dad taught me to read and write and speak. But what he really taught me to do was think and to believe in my thoughts that they had value. We used to take these long car rides to Texas and South Dakota, Missouri. And I can remember even at 10 or 12 having these long intellectual conversations, at least they seemed so to me. And just even at that age, feeling like just so amazed at how he engaged with me, how he'd talk with me as if I was any other grown-up, and that did something to me. He'd add his own thoughts, some depth to what I was saying, and he just made me feel so smart and bright and special. So that's Dad's legacy in me. Through his wholehearted acceptance of me as a person, through his confidence that was just so genuine and casual and automatic, he gave me the gift of confidence in myself, a sense of self-worth that stayed with me and guided me long after I grew up and moved away. In every stage of my life, in everything I took up along the way, school, sports, marriage, fatherhood, a career, he didn't just approve, he wholeheartedly, genuinely celebrated it. He accepted me without reservation when I was a skinny, pimply kid, entirely unsure of myself, and he built me up when I didn't think I was good enough. He pushed me to participate, to try, to believe. He was my safety net, and to this day, it feels like he'll be there to catch me. Dad built a career, a life, around accepting other people and helping them realize their own value. I'm the better for it. We all are.
Jack Fitzmyer was Jim's personal and professional friend. and is the executive director of the American Academy of Religion. Jack?
Good morning. I serve as the executive director of the American Academy of Religion, the AAR, which is an organization that was really dear to Jim Wiggins' heart. It's a learned society to which he gave a good deal of leadership, and today, in no small part because of Jim, it's the world's largest society devoted to the critical study of religion. I'm honored to be here today on behalf of the board and the staff and the membership of the AAR. Despite having worked in two Methodist theological schools, I'm not much prone to piety, at least not in the contemporary Christian sense. There's, of course, an older understanding of piety that has to do with respect and reverence for one's forebears and elders. And that's the sense of piety that I've been thinking about since I learned about Jim's death. Though Jim and I were not close friends, we shared a kinship based on another Christian notion, our vocations. Jim served as the AAR's executive director from 1983 to 1991. Barbara DeConcini followed him in that role for 15 years. And I arrived at the Luce Center in 2006. So in thinking about what I might say this morning, I trolled the AAR archives. And actually, we have an archives, and Jim had a hand in that, too. There I found two items, two documents of note, and I think I've seen them over the years, but rereading them sort of jogged my memory about a number of things. The first is a document, a single-page document, that simply lists Jim's accomplishments at the AAR. It's sort of Wiggins by the numbers. During his term, the AAR membership increased, its annual budgets grew, its publishing program thrived, its staff quadrupled, and the annual meeting, which we still do, and still is the kind of the crown in our, the jewel in our crown, it's shown during Jim's time. Jim did excellent work for the AAR, and we're the better for it. The second document is quite different. It's a transcript of an interview that Barbara DeConcini did with Jim in 2002. The transcript is 60 pages long. It was a long conversation, and there's laughter in it. If I saw in the first document data and numbers, in the second I saw themes, and these really resonated quite deeply and forcefully with me. The first theme has to do with intellectual identity. Jim's tenure as executive director took place during a season in which departments of religion and religious studies were being untangled from college Bible departments. Jim's own professional identity sort of bore this out. He was theologically trained, and he became an historian of Christian theology. And he spent the bulk of his career here in Syracuse as a professor of religion, in a department of religion. Like Jim, the AAR itself is an artifact of this shift. Until 1963, we were called the National Association of Biblical Instructors. Ever since the name change, and notwithstanding all the growth, we continue to struggle with our intellectual identity. We count in our membership thousands of theological educators with strong ties to denominations, atheists who wish that the first group would go away, and social scientists who treat religion scientifically. It's a holy and unholy mess, to be sure. It was that way in Jim's day as well. We're currently in the midst of a planning process, and Jim did one of those as well. And these ongoing worries about confessionalism or teaching religion versus teaching about religion incline me to think that we should shift our mission statement, which we have done, from fostering excellence in the study of religion to fostering excellence in the academic study of religion. Jim saw all this. It's all through this interview. And he knew it would be with us for a long time. And as I read the interview, I took some comfort in his prescience. The second theme has to do with institutional identity. In Jim's day, the AAR coexisted with two other organizations that have been very important in our history. One is the Society of Biblical Literature, and the other is the American Council of Learned Societies. There's a third, Scholars Press, but we should probably talk about Scholars Press over an adult beverage. I think that would be a better place for that. Jim had to navigate tricky waters during his tenure. I think the SBL was both a partner and a foil. That is, we held joint meetings, we did things together, but we also were very different. In our DNA, we sort of knew this. We did not unrelated things, but things quite distinct from each other. If the SBL was a foil for us, we really wanted to be much more like the American Council of Learned Societies, associations of humanists and humanistic social scientists. I've learned a thing about the SBL and the ACLS. We had a family spat with the SBL some years ago, and I would see Jim. It was a very difficult time in our history, and I'd see Jim at annual meetings. And he was always keen to quiz me. And he'd always quietly come up and ask me, "Hey, Jack, how's the partnership going?" As I read that transcript over and over, I realized now that my forebear was looking out for the academy and for me. The third theme has to do with the power of planning. During the interview, Barbara probed Jim very, very carefully, pushed him actually, asking him to identify his signal contributions to the academy. He mentioned some financial problems he had to solve because of some budget deficits. But Barbara pushed, and she didn't want to talk about finance. She said, "During your tenure, all this programming grew, it blossomed. Jim, what was that about? How did that happen?" He said it was just the result of planning work that he'd done. And then he said, and I quote, "I mean, I didn't begin with a vision that would have incorporated all that. It was a corporate enterprise." Jim knew the truth of that. It was and it is corporate. So here's a truism for you. Jim would agree. Academics detest strategic planning. Jim knew that, and I've learned it the hard way at the AAR. But he also knew the work of institution building, and that's just exactly what he was doing. It depends on a combination of some planning, some administrative cleverness, sometimes just dumb luck. As part of our most recent planning at the AAR, our staff and board have spent a lot of time thinking about values. This process was initiated a couple years ago by then-President Tom Tweed. Tom read everything he could get his hands on, documents about the AAR, trying to find values language. The consultant we're using for the current planning process led us in a similar exercise. Barbara's interview with Jim rehearses AAR's history and its growth, and it focuses on data points, you might say. Their conversation is also is shot through with a set of notions, I would think of them as values, that are similar to the ones that the Academy has recently affirmed. Our 2017 values come in pairs: academic excellence and professional responsibility, free inquiry and critical examination, diversity and inclusion, respect and transparency. Part of honoring those who have gone before you, that is part of being pious, has to do with identifying those things we hold in common with our forebears. In one version of my remarks, I noted that I was certain that Jim would have heartily affirmed the values we recently identified. On reflection, though, I think there's a better way to put it. In 2017, the AAR reaffirmed Jim's values. We owe him a great debt, a debt of gratitude. So on behalf of the AAR, I offer Betsy and the Wiggins family our condolences. And I offer Jim my thanks.
Thomas Moore was Jim's doctoral student and dear friend and author of The Care of the Soul. Tom? I met Jim Wiggins in 1972 when the religion department at Syracuse University offered me a scholarship to study for 3 years. I've never forgotten that token of generosity that has allowed me to have a wonderful career. When I arrived, I didn't know where to put my focus. But when I saw Stanley Hopper's wisdom, David Miller's imagination, and Jim Wiggins' beautiful blend of intelligence, civility, and humanity, I had no choice but to become a student of these three, even though that meant giving up other opportunities. Jim inspired me with his way of blending the life of a scholar with that of a leader in his various communities. He didn't merely teach, he became head of the department. He didn't just lecture on religion, he became head of the American Academy of Religion. He didn't just write about religious diversity, he created a multi-faith program in his community. He didn't just enjoy a game of golf, he got seriously involved in the First Tee program that teaches young people civility and how to play. Jim had the vision and compassion to blend a love of scholarship and ideas with a desire to lead people inside and outside the university. When I heard of Jim's passing, I remembered the last time I was with him. He and Betsy and I went to dinner last spring, where we had a relaxed and meaningful conversation. And later, Jim and I talked about his illness. I feared it would be the last time I would enjoy his special way of conversing and his big heart that over the years he often offered to me when I was trying to sort out some challenge in my career. I was always inspired by Jim's earthy sense of humor and deep laugh. I enjoyed his way of using formal language spiced with his wit and a down-home quality. Recently, I read over emails he had sent me. In one, he wrote in his usual formal but tongue-in-cheek way, "My golf addiction shows no sign of being brought under control." I thought he was writing to me as a therapist there, but I knew I couldn't help him. I stayed in Jim and Betsy's house several times where I witnessed their love for each other and for life itself. Now with Jim's passing, we are faced with that mystery of mysteries, the meaning of death. One way I deal with it is to remember that the world around me is essentially materialistic. It prefers to study the brain rather than explores the mysterious soul. It counts as valid knowledge only those things we can see and quantify, not those much more important things that are invisible and subtle. I picture this one-dimensional culture as a thick black circle all around us. But we are all free to step outside that circle, to live in a more beautifully translucent world, where we are not at the mercy of small, literalizing minds. Out there, we can continue and even intensify our relationship with Jim. Feel his presence and go on with our dialogues and conversations with him. We could also embody in our own lives Jim's exemplary values and gorgeous personality. I, for one, am going to take some lessons from my memories of Jim. I'm going to try to take to heart that lesson about being a thinker and a community leader as two sides of one calling. I'm going to try to be a shade more formal in my expression, but always with a twinkle in my eye. Imitating Jim, I'll lead more from my heart, fearlessly and engagingly. And I'm going to surrender, as Jim did, to the compulsion for that insane and uplifting game called golf. I'm here with his family and friends to celebrate, honor, and enjoy the ongoing presence of an extraordinary man who usually disguised himself as an ordinary person. My plan is to have Jim remain in his post as my teacher and friend. This is a bittersweet moment of sadness and joy, and I'm quite sure that Jim would want us to accent the joy.
Thank you, Mark, Karis, Brian, Jack, and Tom. An outpouring of love, affection, and regard for Jim has produced an extended list of persons wishing to share tribute and testimony. Therefore, the sharing of these remembrances will continue during the second portion of the memorial service in the fellowship hall downstairs. At that time, we will be hearing from David Haley, son of Jim's college roommate and dear, dear friend, and Ray Hart, a very dear friend of Jim, both of them in absentia, from Philip Arnold, chairman of the religion department of Syracuse University, and from one of Jim's pastors, Craig French. Mark. Absolutely.
Mention something of just at most important to my brother, and that was about a decade ago, we both were commenting about the society that was developing from the use of computer keyboards and phones, and that the art of interpersonal communication was vanishing. Continue this forward to the point that personal visits will look a lot different in the future than we have enjoyed in the past. The colloquial recognition of what I'm talking about gave rise to the formation of an organization entitled the Societe for the Preservation and Promotion of Bullshit. And any of you that knew my brother came away with a sense of something different that you might not have been able to put your finger on. But if you If you dig into this history, you'll learn a little more about it. But there was a tremendous event occurred during the Thanksgiving holiday in which there was an announcement that the glass ceiling had been shattered and that the gender bar to membership had been lifted. And there are those in this presence that not only will benefit, but were very loud in their praise of that decision and the wisdom. But Jim would want you all to recognize that we each can do some of this in our own way. And just lighten up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Before he died, Jim made a request that Amazing Grace be sung on this occasion. And he requested that Neva Pilgrim sing this early American tune. Neva has graciously agreed, and Dennis Triggs is accompanying her at the keyboard. Amazing. Amazing grace indeed. Jim had an amazing grace of seeing hidden harmonies where others only saw difference, diversity, and division. Jim's work in the Department of Religion, his grace, manifested in sensing and embodying the hidden harmonies in differing
theological perspectives among different scholars of religion and differing faculties. Jim's work in the American Academy of Religion, His Grace, manifested in sensing and embodying the hidden harmonies among thinkers of different genders and different theological geographies. Jim's work in interfaith works here and internationally and in the World Parliament of Religions, His Grace, manifested in sensing and embodying the hidden harmonies within different faiths and ethnicities, and even Jim's work with the first T, His Grace, manifested in sensing and embodying the hidden harmonies between youth and adults, between play and seriousness. Amazing, indeed. Amazing grace. All of this has sensitively and movingly been expressed by Mark, Karis, Brian, Jack, and Tom, so that all that is left for me to say is go in peace. Amen.